Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have back as my guest Dr. William Rea. Dr. Rea is a surgeon. He's retired from surgery now, but he is an environmental specialist and treats patients from all over the world with multiple chemical sensitivity, electromagnetic sensitivity. It's kind of a fascinating story of how a surgeon got exposed to that. But a lot of times surgeons are kind of in a unique position to figure out things because we get to go in the body and actually take a look at everything, which is a little different perspective than medicine doctors have. But in any case, Dr. Rea is back on to talk about silicone sensitivity, how that affects the immune system, and how you can get multiple chemical sensitivity, as well as possible electromagnetic sensitivity with the correct environmental exposures. Welcome, Dr. Rea. Thanks for joining us today.
It's good to talk to you.
So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background and how you became interested in the sensitivity arena?
Well, I'm a cardiovascular surgeon, and of course I did that for several years, and also trauma surgery. And, mm-hmm. of course, we were exposed to implants all the time, using the cardiopulmonary bypass. You had to do certain things because the plastic in the metal triggered problems. And, of course, we put in pacemakers and metal heart valves and tissue heart valves and also grafts for different vessels. And, of course, we found that the patients did react to those, and we usually had to have some kind of antidote for a while, for example, heparin, a blood thinner, Coumadin, to counteract those. And then in addition to that, I had a son who almost died of asthma, and they couldn't fix him, so I had to treat him myself. And I realized that the hypersensitivity part of the body was overwhelming in many people, and we started seeing this on our different patients also. And so it turns out now that there are about 220 different type implants going into the human body, and the human body does react to them. It tries to wall them off if it can, but if it can't, sometimes inflammatory reactions occur, and then hypersensitivity reactions occur. And we're seeing more and more that things like external outdoor pollution, internal pollution, food pollution, water pollution can lower or can increase the patient's body load, pollutants, and therefore trigger this hypersensitive response. So
it's
a natural evolution.
So silicone is a known adjuvant, and if the listeners don't know, adjuvants are what vaccine makers add to the antigen in order to make the body react against the antigen when you get the vaccine. Other adjuvants have been added to vaccines. Squalene was actually added to the anthrax vaccine. It wasn't widely known, but I talked to the scientist who found anti-squalene antibodies in every single person with the Gulf War syndrome, even those who weren't in the Gulf. So this idea of an adjuvant being put in the body, many patients do quite well with silicone. They don't have too many problems until the chemical mixture gets out, and then almost everybody has a problem with it. But some people get really deathly ill right away, any silicone in their body at all, like that's around a VP shunt, any even the little tiny silicone plugs that are put in the tear ducts. In certain HLA types or genetic types, they just have a whole bunch of autoimmune reaction to even a small amount of silicone. So it's probably genetically determined, and we need to be aware of that if we're putting implants in the body.
Well, yes, and the other thing is, of course, the overlooked implants are the teeth, the dental ones where you have just fillings and you get the mercury coming out, or if they replace them with composites, so you have the acrylic and methyl methacrylate, and mm-hmm. we sort of overlook these as being implants, but they really are, and these can increase the body's total body pollutant load and then they get a second hit with something like silicone or metal plates various other type of implants, and that second hit really causes problems. Then in addition to that, people get, like for example, in those silicone breast implants, we have a lot of problems because of the patients also have minerals in there, things like manganese, which can be very toxic and have problems with that also. So it gets rather involved as your time goes on and forces us to look and understand different chemical problems.
Yeah, and even toxicologists aren't really prepared to study this problem because it's not just one chemical. Toxicology seems to be the effect of one chemical, an overexposure of one thing. But when you have a mixture of things, a bunch of different chemicals, that some are hydrophilic, some are hydrophobic, some are known carcinogens, others are, you know, then they're interacting with other environmental toxins. I think that this is a real problem. Like in my patients, if they've got mercury fillings, especially cracked mercury fillings, and that can often lead to high blood pressure, it can lead to yeast overgrowth in the body. And one of the rheumatologists once told me that he tested 3,000 women with leaking or ruptured silicone implants, and 3,000 had candidiasis, not unlike AIDS patients. You know, almost 100% of them have candidiasis as well because they don't have T-cell immunity. So you add mercury toxicity onto that, which, like, I had that. I had, I think, almost 12 fillings, and many of them were cracked. And so I had to get those out before I could really get control of the candidiasis problem once my breast implant started to leak. So, but people aren't aware. People are, woefully uneducated about the toxins that might be in their teeth, the toxins they may be breathing in, you know, from the air, lead poisoning. For those of us who are older, there was much more lead then when there was leaded gasoline. So
today, pesticides.
And pesticides, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about pesticides. They're hard to get out of the body. That's what we found in our detox programs.
Yeah.
What have you found?
Well, there are different types, of course, and the big ones are pyrethroids, right, today, but also organophosphate pesticides. And the ones that are extremely hard are the chlorinated pesticides. I mean, I still see people with DDT and DDE, transaminochlor, things like that in them that are very long-acting. And, you know, DDT has a half-life of 50 years, so it'll be around for 150. So a lot of people come in and with implant sensitivity, and you've got to try to get that those chlorinated pesticides out of them or the others, and you have to put them on, you know, do sauna and organic food and clean up their house, be sure it's not in there, because they may be still constantly exposed to it. So I like to look at a thing. Go ahead.
We've been using Dr. Overman's electrolysis foot bath. It's a foot bath. You put salt in the water and hook it up to an electromagnetic zapper, and then you put ozone in it. And I get a lot of chemical burns because I do a lot of workman's comp. And
sure.
we'll put the patient in that, either their feet or their hands, depending on where their chemical exposure was. And they say the room smells like the chemical they were exposed to. So it's actually coming out. It's volatile. You know, it doesn't turn the water colors. It's not like, you know, an ionic foot bath, but it's a volatile thing. And one of my friends got exposed to chlorine, and I put him in it, and the whole room was smelling like chlorine. So I do think they work. And,
well, that's good. That's another modality, and of course, along that modality is you have to sort of teach the person to sweat again. And a lot of these people with implant syndromes can't sweat anymore, and so their detox systems shut down. You put them in sauna, and you can't stand going in the sauna. You put them in a less polluted rooms like we have, and all of a sudden, like you say, the odor lights up in the room. And, of course, mm-hmm. once you can get them sweating, you don't even like to walk in the room because of the odor, because it's strongly releasing, which shows that the body is a big sponge and that if the system gets overloaded, you got problems.
Yeah, it really does. And most of the chemicals that were on that list that Dow Corning had to provide, you know, during the court cases, most of those chemicals, other than the platinum and some of the, have like 10, those two were used for catalyst in the shell, but most of them were hydrophobic chemicals. And because of that, most of them are also carcinogens. You know, they tend to be the toluenes and the, you know, those kind of things, the structures
yes.
that are, they will just go through the plastic too. I mean, they're not limit. I mean, the chemicals, there's not much chemical, but I feel like it moves out pretty quickly. That's why people get Raynaud's syndrome soon after getting implants, because the methyl ethyl ketone goes out and depletes the arginine, and then they get Raynaud's. And, you know, so you can treat them with the electrolysis hand baths if it's their hands or their feet, if it's the feet. And then we give them large doses of arginine, and their Raynaud's go away. Of course, we take out their implants, too. That's important.
Sure.
But basically, you know, we, again, I saw this patient in a Wortman's comp injury. He was cleaning things without gloves with methyl ethyl ketone, and he had all his bones exposed and his fingers. His bones were actually exposed. He had Raynaud's so bad, no surgeon would touch him. They just sent him... they sent him to pain clinic, but he had his bones exposed. It was terrible.
Sure.
And so I treated him for Raynaud's. I closed, I did the amputations or did a crossfinger flap on one of them. And, you know, now I see him back every month. He's fine. There's no more open areas. He still has some pain, obviously, because he had his bones exposed. I mean, the tips of his fingers are still tender. And we have to, you know, every few months do an electrolysis hand bath because this stuff's still coming out, obviously. You know, that pretty much proves that, at least in his case, it was a methyl ethyl ketone, and that was the mechanism of it. I guess the arginine deficiency does something with nitrous oxide in the vessels. You might be able to fill me in on what it does.
I think it causes vascular spasm. The other thing it does, you can get leaks in the vessels, and a lot of people have not only the Raynaud's or the spasm of the blood vessels of the hand, but they have spontaneous bruises, particularly the women, and they also get petechiae, little red spots that look like freckles, and sometimes they'll get acne. And so so these can be the symptoms that go along with the pain. And, of course, the other thing we hadn't talked about was that a lot of times oxygen therapy will help these people, and what we'll do is give them 2 hours of oxygen a day with a little reservoir, cellophane reservoir, and do that for about 18 days. And a lot of times that'll help clear their vascular spasm, you see, and work on clearing their pollutants out of them. So there's a lot of things that can be done that are really what I call benign therapy, like the bath and the sauna and the oxygen therapy. And also the other thing that we've noticed is that the secondary sensitivity, the hypersensitivity part, may be triggered by foods now, or that may be triggered by molds, or may be triggered by some pollen. And sometimes you can neutralize those with the provocation neutralization technique, and they can take shots of those and get desensitized. Because the hypersensitivity part of the vascular phenomena is just legion. And it dawned on me the other day, there's just volumes of animal literature now, and what they do is they sensitize the animals. And how do they do it? By egg albumin. They shoot that into their lungs or blood vessels, and therefore... they've got food sensitivity, and the foods trigger it too, you see. So there's a lot of things that we're learning in the basic science that can help people clinically that like your man and that you've been talking about.
Yeah, some of the patients have leaky gut, which means that about an hour or 2 hours after they eat, they get extremely tired, and then they probably have really high levels of circulating immune complexes right after they eat because the gut doesn't keep them out, and then they can get joint aches and they can get, you know, a lot muscle aches. And if you have them fast, if they're sick, not too sick too fast, their pain goes away because they lose the circulating immune complexes. But I wanted to ask you, some of my patients say that one of the things they notice with this illness is that their veins stand out. You know, their veins, especially in their arms, stand out. What's happening with that?
Well, I think it's either the autonomic nervous system or just the vascular tree. Some of these people's veins get inflamed, and they have phlebitis. I actually reported about 20 years ago on some intractable phlebitis that were being heparinized or blood thinner Coumadin for years, and we were able to clear those people by fasting them and getting rid of their secondary food sensitivities and their other sensitivities that gets the venous circulation in trouble all the time. So you can get either dilatation or constriction, and a lot of times the veins, you get dilatation, you get tiltation, and you get inflammation. So, and you can remove the inflammation. It's quite an interesting phenomenon. Sometimes they trigger complements, and the complement, you know, the giant part of the immune system, will trigger the venous irritation, or it'll trigger the autonomic nervous system and allow them to dilate and stand out.
We see high C3A levels in patients with biotoxin exposures.
That's correct.
I'm on Monsters Inside Me on Animal Planet right now with mold and breast implants. So that was a different kind of monster inside you, huh? And one of my patients had a penicillin allergy, and every time somebody hugged her, this isn't the one on Monsters Inside Me. The one on Monsters Inside Me is about aspergillus, you know, just making somebody deathly ill. But probably next season we should do the one on the patient with a penicillin allergy, and every time somebody hugged her, she had an anaphylactic reaction, and it turned out she had penicillamine inside the implant.
Yeah, see, there you are. I've got two implants that we took out on a patient that are brown. They look like brown eyes, and they were aspergillus.
Yeah, that's aspergillus, exactly.
And aspergillus, of course, the aspergillus toxin is very detrimental.
Very deadly. That's right.
And you can see these responses in the vascular tree at many times before and afterwards because of that toxicity and the hypersensitivity that goes along with it. So you're right.
And of course,
you would want to neutralize by injection those people with penicillin sensitivity so they didn't have to go into anaphylaxis all the time. There's so many angles.
Well, I hate to say it, but I'm the only explanting surgeon now that treats with antifungals. And, everybody should be treated with antifungals, you know, because the biofilm is going to, you know, have yeast and or mold in it. I mean, if it doesn't, the patient generally has yeast or mold somewhere. I had a patient last week who came in, and I didn't think she had anything around her implants, but her eye test, we use a visual contrast sensitivity eye test, and it showed that she had mold on the right side of her body because it caused a problem with just the right eye. That means the mold somewhere on that side of the body. So I said to her, I said, do you have a sinus problem on the right? And she said, yeah. She's had recurrent right sinusitis. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to put you on, I put her on Lamisil, I think. And we'll see if that visual contrast sensitivity doesn't correct itself once we detox. We have to detox the biotoxin, too. Got some things to do that. High doses of vitamin C will do that. And mold sporox from Dr. Overman's real good. But essentially, to get these people well with just a pure mold thing, say saline implant, not texture, because texturing causes all sorts of chemical problems, but just mold, where, you know, they can get better pretty quickly if you get the right antifungal. Of course, you usually have to treat for several months.
Yes, that's
and,
true.
Yeah, but, you know, it's really weird. In the plastic surgery literature, it's actually published that mold can grow in or around implants, right? But
yes.
Explanting surgeons don't treat with antifungals.
I know. It's crazy, isn't it? Because
it's crazy.
Should.
I mean, it's an infection.
Yeah.
I mean, or a contamination. But, I mean,
yeah.
sometimes it's really an infection because they have burning pain. You know, they have all sorts of neurological symptoms on the side that's affected.
Right. Now, this is a thing that one has to do. And it's not just breast implants. See, we have a lot of jaw implants that have similar things. And also some of the orthopedic implants, the hips and the other ones.
So my patients ask me fairly frequently, because a lot of them have titanium implants in.
Yes.
If their titanium implants are causing a problem, what
yes,
would you say to them?
Oh, definitely. I'd say I'm going to test you for it because there are two types of titanium alloys, of which there's five different metals in there, and then there's pure titanium, and we've had a ton of those patients that we've been able to reproduce their pain and with the provocation neutralization, and then we take either we treat them and their pain goes away, or they get their implant out and it goes away. So those are two that can be. I know the literature is very cautious about saying that titanium is inert, but I've found some literature now that shows it's not true, and of course our clinical experience shows that.
And the pain that they have, is that like a pain around the plate, or is it more diffuse
pain?
Yeah,
but yes, it is. But of course, it can then spread to the nerves, and they don't have to just have it in the area where the implant is. They can have it peripherally, just like shooting pains or very sharp pains in the legs or sharp pains in the belly or in the neck. You know, wherever the metal implants are. And, of course, the stainless steel ones can be just as bad.
Well, I go in there and actually remove those plates sometimes. And
yes,
the ones that
too.
Are symptomatic have this black gunk in them, in the screw holes. It's not very pretty.
Well, yeah. Well,
I would imagine that's got mold in it. What do you think?
Well, it may have mold. It may have mold, or it may be just corrosive reaction from the metals on electrical problems.
Yeah,
I think that's another thing that we're starting to see is the dang metal implants can act like antennas, and they can cause electrical problems on people. And so you see some of those happening also.
Yeah, I had a patient who had a Verichip injected in her without her permission.
Yeah.
And she it actually broke when it was injected, and she was digging pieces out. And I think I saw in 2007, and it had been injected in 1999. And she had a wound in her arm from that length of time. But she came here, and I took it out. It was in different pieces. It was very close to the radial nerve. And she had horrible electromagnetic sensitivity involving that arm. Just horrible.
Yeah, I've seen that many times now, and they're sometimes very easy to treat, but sometimes very difficult because so many, you know, the smartphones and the portable phones and the smart meters are put every place now, and you see all these towers with the antennas, and those metals can pick it up, you see, and then once the nerve gets sensitized, the nerves can pick it up.
So let's start talk a little bit about multiple chemical sensitivity. I mean, the classic case of that is somebody gets sprayed with pesticides accidentally, and then they develop horrible sensitivities to all sorts of chemicals, can't walk through the mall, you know, cosmetic section, you know, can't even walk in the mall if it's real bad. So that's the classic thing for overexposure to chemicals or, you know, what actually happens? when somebody is terribly exposed to chemicals that causes a sensitivity?
What happens is that they have odor sensitivity, and you know that the olfactory, the nose, in the olfactory nerve there is not really a nerve. It's actually an outgrowth of the brain. And this is the brain's probe to the outside environment. And so it becomes sensitized. And then what happens when it becomes sensitized, if just say that one pesticide did it, then it starts spreading. The sensitivity spreads. And the next thing you know, you get sensitive to natural gas, and you're sensitive to perfumes, and you're sensitive to any types of odors. And so that part of the brain can go two ways. You know, the nerve innervation goes to the hypothalamus, which regulates your pulse and blood pressure and temperature and so on, so you can have those deregulated. Or it'll go to the amygdala, which has to do with emotions, and you can get depressed, and you get hyper either way, and the rest of the limbic system that goes to. So it's anatomically, it's quite well seen now, and there are changes in each of these areas when you get this exposure. Now, the other thing can happen, of course, is the other known cause that's tied with pesticides is natural gas, heat from the house or stoves. And those are the two biggest sensitizers for the chemical sensitivity. And so one has to, again, decrease the load of pollutants so that the patients can recover and their immune system and their sensory systems get better.
So I know the gas company can come out and check for the levels of natural gas in your house. Is that something that, you know, obviously you would want to do?
Yeah, you want to do, but you can't believe them. Because here's the problem. Here's the problem is their instruments are set too high. And so it's fine to check for the leak. I have no problem with that. But what we found is that with chronic exposure of a well-fired gas stove or a well-regulated furnace, the leak is still too much for the chemically sensitive people, you see. And that that chronic 7-day-a-week exposure is what gets them. And they may go on for several years and then, wham, come down with the chemical sensitivity because of that.
Right. Okay. What are other common exposures? You said pesticides, I guess, like walking. You wouldn't want to walk barefoot in your yard then.
You wouldn't want to put anything in your yard that has a pesticide in it. And of course, a lot of people do, and they can track that in the house. The number three exposure that we found in about 30,000 patients has been formaldehyde. And the reason for that is that formaldehyde is in press board and plywood, and of course, and it's also in some clothing, and it's also in some bedding and things like that. And it's very toxic. It's obviously a known preservative to pickle everything from human tissue. And, of course, some people have labs where they're working that will cause the formaldehyde exposure. So that is the number three one. And, of course, a lot of rugs and carpets have it in. And then finally,
new carpets are a real danger to people who are sensitive. Yeah.
They have both
the
dyes.
What about the heating up of soft drinks? Isn't there something that can turn into formaldehyde?
Number one, soft drinks have a lot of additives and preservatives and colorings in them, and they can be sensitive. The other thing, if they're in plastic, which more and more are becoming that way, you leach off the volatile plastics from the liquid and the acid that these drinks come from. And so they can have a very toxic load and contribute to it and cause these things.
Yeah, the plastics might cause problems with the hypothalamus and also act as estrogen-like substances sometimes, too.
Yeah, they do. They can be hormone mimics. And so in the males, they can suppress their androgen, and the females can alter their periods and alter some of the problems with it. We see a lot of hormone mimics from the plastics.
Yeah, I just wonder about the high risk of prostate cancer and breast cancer. It seems to be going up. Oh, I have a question to ask you about that. I think 85% of breast cancers are in the upper outer quadrant, and of course, that's where we see the majority of fibrocystic disease as well. Do you think fibrocystic disease is a reaction, to toxins in that part
yes.
of the breast?
Yes, I do. We've seen it many times. And you withdraw and decrease the pollutant load, and it starts getting better.
Right. Yeah, you have to combine a detox program with your anti-estrogen program and increasing your progesterone. We usually use Endoplex and progesterone cream, and then you can even use castor oil, Edgar Cayce's castor oil wraps to detox
yes.
the breast.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, yeah. And of course, the breast being a lot of fatty tissue will attract the solvents and the different toxics, And so you get both the estrogen mimic effect, and then you get the toxics, which will light in there.
Yeah. So I think, a lot of the increase in breast cancer, especially in people who don't have a family history of it, might be related to, the exposure of these things.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So really, infrared saunas, those are good, regular saunas. You think the chemicals out that might be involved here?
Well, sometimes they do. We have a big program of that and have done it for about 20 years now. It seems to take it out of some people. But this has to be accompanied by high nutrients so that they can cope with toxic when they come out,
Yeah, and also the mineral depletion that can occur with any detox program, foot baths or saunas.
Absolutely.
They can lose a lot of potassium in
it. We get a lot of intravenous vitamin C and minerals, multi-minerals and multivites to people who are undergoing detox because they need all of it. And you never know which patient is going to be depleted of what nutrient,
Right.
And you sort of have to give a comprehensive program to figure that out.
Yeah. Well, we treat a lot of people with magnesium malic acid just for the muscle aches, and that seems to work pretty well, during the detox program, of course. But, I have a lot of people who say that if they miss several doses of that magnesium malic acid, the muscle aches start to come back. So.
Oh, yes. Well, or any kind of magnesium. What we found, a lot of people can tolerate only one type of magnesium. I mean, one person, it might be mag gluconate, another might be sulfate, and another might be whatever. So we always have a variety of them just to try to see which one they can tolerate because it does help pain and it does help muscle spasm. You can stop it with it many times.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about electrical sensitivity. How did you first get exposed to electrical sensitivity?
Well, I got exposed to it by shocking about several thousand hearts after bypass. That's how I got exposed to it. and then some people came in and this was when we were really in the chemical problem, 20 or 30 years ago. And there'd be isolated patients say, "Doc, I can't tolerate television. I can't tolerate fluorescent lights. I can't tolerate some electrical gadgets." And I thought, well, what the heck? Yeah, that makes sense because we can shock a heart. What's the difference between a living person and a dead heart person? It's electric. So why couldn't the electrical system be screwed up? And, of course, now with the new sophisticated electric computers, electric phones, and so on down the line, smart meters, Wi-Fis, the electrical sensitivity is skyrocketing. And, of course, we had some specifically designed rooms that were screened with metal, particularly copper and the like, where you could create what's called a Faraday cage, and then you could challenge people with the different frequencies on the electromagnetic spectrum, and what would happen is you'd hit certain frequency and all of a sudden, bang, all their symptoms would be reproduced. And so we did that for years. And what's interesting to us is that some people have certain frequencies that knock them out, and other people have a whole range of electric sensitivities that bother them. And the other thing is we noticed, is that more and more people tend to wear rubber shoes rather than leather-soled shoes. And so
right.
With the rubber comes directs electricity back into them, whereas the leather ones will discharge when they walk on the ground. And
mm-hmm.
so people probably aren't discharging as well as they should. Plus, the fact is that a lot of people sleep with their TVs in their bedroom or the radios at the head of the bed, or there'll be electric
mm-hmm.
power coming in. And all these things can trigger the sensitivity. Now, there's also a combination where 80% of the electrically sensitive people are sensitive to chemicals. And so you have to treat
right.
both the chemical load and the electrical load in those people. But the other 20% are pure electrical, and you have to treat them that way. Now, they're also very metal-prone, and any metal in them will act like antennas and draw electricity
mm-hmm.
in. And so you have to take that in consideration. I had one guy who had a jaw implant, and he could hear a radio station from it. He could tell you exactly. You could turn on the radio and get that same thing he had. He could tell you.
Oh, my goodness.
Which was,
and that was because of the metal, like the plate, the big plate
yeah.
they have in the jaw?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
the bone plate, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a pretty
yeah.
hefty dose of metal. I mean, that's a
yeah,
big
it is.
Plate. We
pretty,
used to put it in.
Pretty big antenna, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's, I can see where that would be. So getting the metal out is important with that. And getting the chemicals out, you do chemical detox, obviously, for multiple chemical sensitivity patients.
Right. And then we neutralize all the metals.
You neutralize the metals. How do you do that?
Yeah, with the provocative neutralization technique, injection therapy. And
okay.
It's like we were talking about the titanium. And that seems to really help them quite a lot. We'll have patients who have to take their own injections for every day for two or three, 4 weeks, and then as their sensitivity
mm-hmm.
dampens down, they can do it about once every 4 days or so. And then eventually they get off it when they lose their sensitivity.
So do you think there's a particular type of patient that becomes electrically sensitive? Say the ones that weren't chemically sensitive first, because I think I can understand how multiple chemical sensitivity can translate into electrical sensitivity. But
yeah.
The ones that weren't chemically sensitive, do you see a pattern? Or just an overexposure to electrical pollution?
Yeah, I think that's what we see is that they get too exposed, and then it comes down with it. And, you know, some of them, they know right after they've had their implants that they're not right with electricity anymore. Others,
mm-hmm.
it hasn't got anything to do with implants, you know. They don't have
right.
any implants. And their nerves
are there any jobs?
Satisfied.
Or are there any professions that put somebody at risk for electrical sensitivity?
Well, of course, the one you mentioned, pesticide exposure. You know, the pesticide workers
yeah.
can get both.
Right.
And some people who work in power plants and work around a lot of, like engineers that work around electricity all the time,
mm-hmm.
Can get sensitive. And of course, you know, there's ample evidence now that electricity can cause malignancies, and so
yeah,
those people.
Yeah, the MRI techs, before they were properly shielded, used to get a lot of lymphomas.
Absolutely. And all these radiation techs have to watch that. And apparently there are higher incidences of malignancies in just a certain type of people who are overexposed to electricity.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would make sense. Did you read Dr. Becker's book on, let's see, Robert Becker? What is the name of that book? The Electrical Body or something?
There's two books, one by Becker, Electrical Man, and the other by Cyril Smith, was Electromagnetic Man. And
there you go.
You know, yeah. Becker's work was a pioneering work first, and it was just fabulous because he healed bones with electricity. And it's like
he was an orthopedic surgeon. I'll tell you, these surgeons.
That's right.
Yeah, these surgeons get to the heart of things, don't they?
You bet.
I really think it has to do with us being able to look directly at what's going on.
Well, I've always felt that.
And then being intuitive, you know, I mean,
right.
You know, putting correlations and then having ideas and seeing things and saying, hey, you know, something's not right here.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, and you get to observe physiology in action.
Yeah, exactly. So we have a little bit more time here. Can you give your contact information and the name and location of your clinic in Dallas?
I'm our clinic's called the Environmental Health Center of Dallas. And the phone number is 214-368-4132. And they can give you information on all these kind of things. And we do have one building at the Marriott of about 22 beds that are environmentally designed to be less polluted, and people can stay in those while they're working in the clinic. And our clinic has been designed to be less polluted, and we have no carpets and all ceramic tile and porcelain and glass and things to it. Sophisticated filters that we design to keep this at a minimum so that you can reduce your total load and find out what's going on.
Well, thank you. There are also things that you can do to put on your smart meters. Like, I called the power company here to see if I could get rid of the smart meters, and the answer was no,
yeah. Right.
Which was interesting. But there are some things that ZeroPoint makes, and there's also things that some biochips that the military design that you can put on your cell phone. And I have actually both on mine because I have a concerning pigmented lesion in my retina that I think is being aggravated by things. So I'm very careful. Like right now I'm using a landline. I don't use my cell phone very much.
I don't either for that reason.
Yeah.
Well, you could do it on the smart meter just as a test. If it's on one of your walls, you know, outside, if there's any gap between it, you can put aluminum plate or aluminum foil. Or if it's inside, you can put aluminum foil and aluminum wallpaper, and that'll screen it out.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
And it's so simple to do. You can just staple it up there first and see if it works, you know.
I had one
problem with a patient come in, and she could only walk on one half of her house. In the other half, she would get all her symptoms from electrical sensitivity. And it wasn't her smart. She didn't have a smart meter on her house yet. Her neighbor had one on the one side, the side where they were next to each other. And it was the neighbor's smart meter who was beaming into them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Were they able to fix that with aluminum foil, or did they have to do something else?
No, because it was the neighbors, and it was shooting to them.
Boy. Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So, the cell towers are a big problem. I've interviewed a lot of people. I interviewed Dr. Carlos. He did $20 million worth of research for the cell phone companies, found that you really do get increased eye parotid and brain tumors, including neuroepithelial malignancies, and then of course they didn't like that finding, so his house burnt down and he went to South America and wrote the book. So anyway, But there, yeah, there's a lot of cover up of the problems here, and definitely not, not out in the mainstream media. People are sick; they don't know why they're sick. The worst things are if you get this a life-threatening malignancy out of nowhere.
That's right.
And it, yeah.
There's a lot of gliomas,
right. So what would you recommend? I would imagine what you would recommend children not use them at all because of the data out on that.
Yeah,
there's really no good way to shield children.
They're going to be using the computers, and that's going to be enough for them, and they really need to even shield the computers, so they don't need the dang portable phones, you know.
Right, right. Well, there's things you can wear that help shield you, and, you know, different companies make those.
People who
do your patients use Q-Links and things like that to help?
Yes. Yeah, I think some of them do some. I don't think there's a good solution yet because there's just too much out there, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Electromagnetic waves out there.
Well, there's only one place in the country that is actually made to be completely free of electromagnetic interference. I think it's in Virginia. Have you heard about this place?
No, I haven't. I'd like to know about it.
I've interviewed some people on the radio show. I've been doing this show about 17 years, so I've talked to a lot of people. And evidently the government keeps this area. It's in Virginia in the mountains, in the rural area. And there's an area they keep completely electromagnetically, you know, quiet. And if you live in this area and you, have a stereo system or something, they'll come on your door and tell you to get rid of it.
Yeah, really well.
I mean, they actually monitor it. Yeah.
That's interesting. I'd like to know more about that. You know, I've got people living near military bases who have developed severe electrical sensitivity.
Right. I would imagine if they're anywhere near the HARP stations, there's quite a bit of electromagnetic interference there.
Yes.
But that one's in Alaska. I know one of the HARPs in Alaska.
Well, but I mean just regular military bases in America, Army bases, you know.
Right.
And you don't, because you don't know what really goes on there.
It's all classified. I know that. I was in the military 13 years. I was in the Air Force.
Okay.
It's all classified. Let me tell you.
Yeah. Well, there's very complex subjects out there that we need to get more information on.
It is. And, you know, people like you and me, we need to train other doctors in what we do.
Absolutely. Well, we do have, of course, the Academy of Environmental Medicine and also the Pan-American Allergy Society. And we have, of course, and actually we're going to have one in April in St. Louis. And we're going to be teaching some of both chemical and electromagnetic sensitivities.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's excellent. Well, we're coming up on the end of the hour. I want to thank you for joining us today. Fascinating topic, one that I think all the patients need to know about so they can limit their exposures to chemicals and electromagnetic fields. The silicone issue is still a problem because they've reapproved silicone and haven't changed the implants very much, so that will be an ongoing problem.
Yes,
because,
it will.
Of course, these devices will fail, usually about 8 to 15 years, according to the engineering data. And when they fail, then the people get sick. And
that's right.
It can be very difficult to tell that an implant's leaking. They can tell if it's ruptured, but it'll leak long before it'll rupture. So
that's true.
Yeah.
It might even leak from the beginning.
That's right. There are studies from the implant companies that show it does leak right from the beginning.
That's right.
And they can be found online. Mentor published a study that its implant leaks less platinum than Allergan's does. And my response to that study was, gee, I thought they took the platinum out of the implants. But I guess I was wrong.
Well, we thought they took the manganese out, too, and we found out they didn't. And they just quit talking about it, you know, and manganese can be very toxic.
Right. Well, maybe it's classified.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. It's been a great conversation, and we'll have to have you back on again.
Pleasure's mine. Glad to do it anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is Dr. Susan Kolb. We've had a fascinating interview with Dr. William Rea on silicone toxicity, multiple chemical sensitivity, and electromagnetic sensitivity in the treatment, and also the risk. Next week, we will be interviewing Dr. Jennifer Howard, Your Ultimate Life Plan, How to Deeply Transform Your Everyday Experience and Create Changes That Last. And then Christine Page on the 30th, The Healing Power of the Sacred Woman, Health, Creativity, and Fertility for the Soul. Kent Boxberger is giving the Abraham Hicks Meetup Group, Law of Attraction, every Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. at the Dunwoody office. We have the Noetic Science meeting on the 21st at 7:30 at the Dunwoody office. Tricia McCannon is giving a lecture on galactic awakening and the birth of Homo Luminous. And then on the 26th, I'm giving a lecture on breast implants, What You Need to Know, at 7:30, also at the Dunwoody office. Anyway, this is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Join us next week.